Welcome to TTM Cast, the podcast for TTM autograph collectors, sponsored by sportscardforum.com, the ultimate in sports card trading and discussion, and by thetrovesportsden.com. Come and hang out and chat with baseball pros online. And now, here's our host, Jeff Baker.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to TTM Cast, the podcast for the TTM autograph collector. My name is Jeff Baker, and I'm your host for the program. We are on Season 2, Episode 38 of TTM Cast. Today is Sunday, October 18th. I've got a little late jump. I'm recording this between the 1 and 4 o'clock NFL games. So the 1 o'clock games are in the books. My Patriots have lost. We are having a tough year with all the COVID. I thought they might have a chance to come back, but you know what? I guess Cam Newton is not Tom Brady, so a different team and a different year this year. So we are recording this in between the 1 o'clock and 4 o'clock games. We have a great, real fun interview this week with Pat Combs, former Major League pitcher. He pitched for the Phillies. He's written a new book called More Than the Score. And we talk about Pat's new book. We talk about his career. We talk about his collecting. Pat was and is a baseball card collector, and talk about him dealing with TTM requests. So kind of an interesting interview. I think it's really fun to hear about a former major league player, and Pat wrote a new book. It's called More Than the Score. Go check it out on Amazon, and it's basically kind of everywhere you can find books online. So check out Pat's book, More Than the Score, and we have our interview with Pat coming up. If you want to send any feedbacks, questions, comments, or just to be interested in being a guest on a future show, please send me your emails to ttmcast@yahoo.com. Once again, my email address is ttmcast@yahoo.com. I am on Twitter at castttm. I am on Instagram at ttmcast. And I am all over Facebook and in many Facebook groups, TTM groups and collecting groups, posting there all the time. So please check all those sites out. Also, the podcast is available basically anywhere podcasts are available, including Spotify, Podbean, Google, iTunes, Stitcher, and we are on TuneIn. So if you have an Alexa device, all you have to do is say, Alexa, play TTM Cast Podcast, and you can hear this episode or any of my old episodes. So check it out there. We also have a forum on Sports Card Forum. So as I see, we're all over the internet. Please spread the word. Let people know what we're doing. We are picking up new listeners all the time. So I want to thank my dedicated listeners, fans that listen every episode, and some of the new listeners. So welcome to the show. Our first segment is going to be Baker's Dozen, just kind of a brain dump of what's been going on in the hobby for the past week. Our next show will be next Sunday, October 25th, and that is going to be my Halloween show. So we're going to have a trick-or-treat stories, TTM trick-or-treat stories, in terms of I've been asking people on the internet, and I asked people last week, and there's still time to send me a trick-or-treat story if you have one, a TTM trick-or-treat story. I'm looking for kind of TTM tricks or TTM treats that you've gotten, and also any horror stories you have, any bad things that might have happened in regards to sending out TTM requests or even our autograph requests. So if you have any TTM requests or stories, send those to me at ttmcast@yahoo.com. Once again, it's ttmcast@yahoo.com. Just put in the subject line trick-or-treat story. I've gotten, four or five already. We've recorded some. I've got a few more that I need to record this week. So if I use your trick-or-treat story on the podcast next week, you will get a treat. I will send you a TTM Cast treat. With that said, a couple other things that are happening. I mentioned it last week, but stamps are going up at the beginning of the year, so stock up on your stamps because the cost of doing TTM just got more expensive. I just saw that the 2022 National will be back in Atlantic City, which is great, coming back east. Unfortunately, this year's show in Atlantic City got canceled. Next year's National will be in Chicago, and the following year it will be back in Atlantic City. So that that is a very exciting, especially for us East Coasters. I saw Brooks Robinson is moving. He's requesting that no one sends him any cards for a little while he moves. So if you have something out to Brooks Robinson, he may not get signed, but I wouldn't send anything new until we get a new address for Hall of Famer Brooks Robinson. Just a couple things. They'd like to congratulate the Tampa Bay Rays for beating the Houston Astros last night and heading to the World Series. Also like to thank the Los Angeles Lakers, boo Lakers, for winning the NBA title. They certainly were the best team with Davis and LeBron, so congratulations to the Lakers. And then we have the great Game 7 tonight with the Dodgers and Braves. I'm rooting for the Dodgers because I'm a big Mookie Betts fan and I'm a Dodger fan from way back. So I'm rooting for the Dodgers tonight. The game is we'll probably have had already been played when you listen to this, but the Dodgers, you know, I'm rooting for the Dodgers, and hopefully we get a Dodgers Rays World Series. So as I said, if you have any trick or treat stories, send them to me at ttmcast@yahoo.com. That's TTM trick or treat stories I'm looking for next week's episode. And now on to our Vern Rapp Minute. Our Vern Rapp Minute is dedicated to Mr. Vern Rapp every week, of course, because I sent a TTM request to Mr. Vern Rapp after he had passed. So this is just kind of a rundown of people who had passed this week, and we continue to lose Hall of Famers, which is such a shame. We lost Fred Dean, the Hall of Famer from the San Diego Chargers and San Francisco 49ers. Mr. Dean was 68 years old. He passed away from complications from COVID virus. We also lost, of course, Hall of Famer, second baseman from the Cincinnati Reds and Houston Astros and a few other teams during his illustrious career. Joe Morgan, he was 77. We're having kind of a run of losing Hall of Famers, people that you and I grew up with. And it's sad to see some of the people that we rooted for and respected as players pass away in recent weeks. But condolences going out to Joe Morgan and his family, as well as Fred Dean's family. A couple other people we lost in the world of sports and entertainment. Mr. J.W. Powers, who was a kind of a utility player for a number of teams, including the Browns, Tigers, Indians, Senators, and Cardinals from 1952 to 1959. He played catcher, third base, outfielder. He was kind of all over the place. But he must have been a useful player back in his day. He recently passed us away this week. And in the world of entertainment, we lost Tom Kennedy, who was a kind of a game show host, definitely a game show host in the 70s and into the 80s. He was hosted Name That Tune. For you youngsters that might not know, Mr. Tom Kennedy, he was 93 years old. And finally, we lost Conchetta Farrell, who was played Berta. Her famous role was on Berta on Two and a Half Men, and she was 77. So that wraps up Vern Rapp Minute for this week. Our condolences go out to their families and friends, and we're sorry for their losses.
This week's TTM returns are brought to you by Sports Card Forum. Find players' addresses, see who's signing, and more, all for free. SportsCardForum.com, the ultimate in sports card trading and discussion.
Now it's time for returns to the week. We've got a few returns kind of rolling in. Let's talk about the failures. We had a couple failures as well. So I sent a return out to ML Carr, former Boston Celtic. He also played for the Detroit Pistons, and he was a coach for the Celtics. Sent it to his home, and I got an RTS. So it looks like Mr. Carr is not signing anymore. I also got a return from Artis Gilmore. The second time I tried to send, I sent him something. I'd sent him a 80-81 tops card, and I got my card back, not signed. He sent back my letter signed, so I'm going to consider that kind of a failure. But I see that where if you send him photos, he does sign the photos. Maybe he doesn't sign cards. I don't know. I didn't send a donation, so I do have his autograph on a letter, but it's not really the same. I was hoping to have it on a card, so I'm going to consider that a failure, but I did get his autograph. Then I had a couple more returns. I got Chuck Brinkman, who was a catcher for the Chicago White Sox in the 70s and early 70s, and I got a return on his 1973 Topps card. He signed it in pen. Nice signature. No number or anything, but it was nice to get back. I love the 73 cards. So I got Chuck Brinkman, catcher for the Chicago White Sox. And just a couple more. I sent out a 1970 Topps rookie card for Dennis Lamp, Craig Mitchell, Roy Thomas, and Cardell Camper. It had already been signed by Mr. Lamp and Mitchell, and I sent it out to Roy Thomas to his home in Las Vegas. I think he has a newer address, so if you do send to Roy Thomas, make sure you send it to his Las Vegas address. He did sign it. Nice blue pen. And so now I have three of the four signatures. Unfortunately, Cardell Camper has passed away, but it is a nice addition for my 1978 set. And that took maybe a couple weeks. Chuck Brinkman took a couple weeks. Gilmore took maybe about a month. And ML Carr obviously came back not signed. Then I have one basketball card I sent to John Konkak, who was a center for the Atlanta Hawks. And he went to SMU, and this is on his 1990-91 NBA Hoops card. And he signed a nice black Sharpie with his number below. And that one took, I don't know, just a couple weeks. So it was a fairly quick turnaround. And lastly, for my 1992 game day set, I got Vinny Clark, who was a cornerback for the Green Bay Packers, and he signed a great nice black Sharpie with his number as well. And that took maybe, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks. So the returns are coming in kind of one a day, basically, which I've been getting, which is good. I like that. So I've been sending out a few more, and hopefully we'll get some more returns. But the returns were pretty good this week. I'm very happy with that. And now for our last segment is our interview segment. I had the pleasure of speaking with Mr. Pat Combs last week, who was a pitcher for the Philadelphia Phillies. He pitched on the U.S. Baseball team that won the gold medal in Seoul in 1988, I believe. And we talk about, Pat has written a new book called More Than the Score, which is available on Amazon. And we talk about his new book. We also talk about his career. We talk about his time with the U.S. baseball team. We talk about getting autograph requests and TTM through the mail. We also talk about collecting, because Pat is a baseball card collector since he was a kid. So hopefully you enjoy our interview with former Major League pitcher and now author, Mr. Pat Combs.
This week's interview is brought to you by the Trove Sports Den. Come and hang out and chat with baseball pros from past and present online. Visit thetrovesportsden.com and join in the fun today.
Joining us on the TTM Cast Hotline is from his home in Texas is former Major League pitcher Pat Combs. Pat was an academic All-America at Baylor University. He was later inducted to the Baylor Athletic Hall of Fame. He played a few seasons with the Philadelphia Phillies and spent some time with the Milwaukee Brewers. And most recently and currently, Pat is an author of a brand new book, More Than the Score. And we're going to talk about Pat's career and about Pat's new book, which just came out on Thursday, so it is Sunday, October 18th, and welcome to the program, Pat.
Oh, Jeff, what a pleasure. Thank you. I'm honored to be with you today.
I'm thrilled to speak with you. I had the privilege of devouring the book yesterday, and I was really not sure what to expect when I opened it up. It's called More Than the Score, and it's certainly a Bible, and no pun intended, for parents and coaches on how to deal with youth and their youth, their sons and daughters in youth sports.
Yeah, Jeff, you described it really well. It's a passion of mine in terms of, reaching parents and coaches and how we can use sports and the platform of sport to teach our kids virtue and character. And, I think back to the days when I was going through, youth sports and I played, all of the major sports. I would guess now that I say that, and people are going to get upset when I say baseball, football, and basketball. You know that now there's a bunch of major sports, but
sure,
yeah, not to offend anybody, but all the lacrosse players and soccer players and parents who have you know, sat in the ice hockey arenas for sure, like I did with one of my sons. But you know, I grew up playing the Big Three, and you know, I look back on those days, Jeff, and I'm so thankful I had really great youth coaches, you know, from Little League to Pop Warner to coaches on the basketball court that taught me what life was about. You know, the life skills, the character, the virtuous things that we want our kids to learn through the game. And that was my passion for writing the book, was to help parents in this kind of crazy, hyper-competitive environment now that we live in, that we still need to focus on those things because, you know, most kids now are dropping out of sport at 13, 14, 15 years old. Hey, they got the rest of their lives to live. What have they learned from the game that they can carry on through college and through their young adult years and into their business or wherever they're being called to go to work? And that was really the genesis for the book.
Yeah, I mean, I have a kind of a similar experience with you. I'm not a world-class athlete by any means, but in terms of raising, I have a son who's finishing his senior year at law school, and my daughter is at Emory University. She's going to be she's a junior. So, you know, I guided them through their, you know, their athletic career. My son was actually a varsity swimmer, and so I kind of understand. I coached him in Little League like you coached your kids. I saw the good and bad of it as a coach, just dealing with parents and, you know, just as a parent just sitting on the side and watching other parents react to their kids. And I think you deal with a lot of that in your book that people don't think about sometimes.
Yeah, that's right, Jeff. I mean, to me, it really does go back to what are your goals as a parent? You know, what are you trying to achieve? What's your why? Why your children are involved in sports to begin with. And when we kind of steal the dream of what it's about and the purpose of what it's all about, that's when we get in trouble as parents. And of course, we're seeing that nationwide. I think it's an epidemic, which is unfortunate that we're not letting the kids be kids and let them learn and grow and develop in the game. And that's really what it's designed to do. And, you know, you're talking about, you know, chapter one really talks about, you know, what is your goal, your why? Chapter two goes into the game belongs to the kids. And chapter three is what you were talking about, Jeff. It's are you an asset or liability? Are you a plus as a parent or a coach? Or are you getting in the way of what the game is trying to teach your kids? And that's, we go deep into those first three things because I think you got to get that piece right first. You know, why do you have your kids playing ball to begin with? I get it. Look, I got up at 4:30 in the morning and drove two of my sons to ice hockey practice in Houston, Texas. We only had four sheets of ice, and so we had the worst ice time. So, you know, you think as a parent, well, man, I'm sacrificing a lot to get up on Saturday and Sunday mornings to go get my kids to the ice rink. You know, what do I get out of this? And that's the attitude we've got to avoid as parents. You know, it really is. It's got to be the focus on, hey, this is for the kids. This is for their development. And they're going to come out way better people on the back end if we keep this perspective that it really is more than the score. It's more about their development as young people, that they're going to carry these skills on the rest of their lives.
I think the two things that I took from the book is that, one, communication and not one-way communication. You know, make sure that the kids and you and your spouse are talking, and it's kind of an open forum so that everyone feels free to express themselves. And then also, I think passion is required, and not your passion, the kids' passion, especially if you have a kid that has any semblance of talent. Would you agree?
No, absolutely, Jeff. If your passion as a parent for your kid to be successful is greater than their passion to be successful, that's a mismatch, right? So it gets down to the communication. You know, what does my child need from me as a parent for them to be successful? And to have those interactions with them is really important. That communication piece, you know, to even ask the kids, are they enjoying the sport? Do they want to be a part of a sport at a certain level? Like, I, you know, all my kids were very competitive. Sounds like yours were too, you know. And so when you get a competitive natured child and they want to play the game at a different level, well, that's going to take a different level of commitment. It's going to take a lot more resources as well. We talk about that. You know, when my three sons wanted to play competitive sports in select leagues, And you're taking the jump from, you know, rec ball, which may cost you $100 to sign up and play, to select ball, which may cost you, you know, $10,000 a summer for your kid to play. So it's that, not only that commitment, but the communication, the recognition. And then, you know, really from a parent's perspective, asking yourself, what can I do to help my son or daughter be successful in the sport that they're desiring to play? And the second question you should ask yourself is, what can you do that could put yourself in that liability category of being an overbearing parent or a lawnmower parent or a helicopter parent or making all those parent mistakes that we see now in these select leagues where the parents just become so overbearing because they're so overcommitted and they're not letting their kids reap the rewards of playing competitively and learn those skills. And it's just it just becomes a battle inside the house. And that's not what you want. The kids are going to lose that passion if that's what occurs.
One of the stories in the book that really bothered me was a story you told of the baseball player, the pitcher. You know, I think he was 17 years old, and he had a lot of talent, and he, you know, he thought he might even be able to make pro ball, but his father was really one of these overbearing parents and kind of turned the kid off. That really bothered me.
Yeah, Jeff, and I wanted to make the book real. I wanted to make it transparent. There's a few stories like that are painful to read through. But, you know, I would say that's hopefully it's not a high percentage. I would guess maybe 1-3% of parents and maybe more than that. But even considering that there's, you know, millions of kids playing sport, if we've got 3% of parents behaving like Joey's dad, that's the story you're referring to. And that was a real story. That was a young man that I met when I was 17 years old, who played for a select club in Cincinnati, Ohio. We actually went up to play a Palomino World Series event there, and that's where I met this young guy. He was the ace pitcher for this particular select team, and the kid was throwing back then, in those days, when you're throwing high 80s, it's probably like low 90s in today's guns, right?
So sure.
He was a flamethrower, and he had all the talent. You could see it. You know, he was already destined for a Division I scholarship, but it was going to be a high draft pick, and he just had one of those dads that was so overbearing. And the story that you relate to is there was a situation that occurred many times after games when he would confront his son, and his son didn't have the game his dad thought he should have, and he told his son he was an embarrassment to the family, and you know he wanted to rip that family name off the back of his jersey, and you know that's a real story, and years later, I met this guy again at a training at a conference up in Cincinnati, and his buddy was actually at that particular training as well and told me what had happened to his career. Joey, the guy I referred to, he couldn't even talk about it. He had just completely tried to erase that from his memory bank because of just the terrible atmosphere his dad provided, you know, in sport.
Yeah, it really bothered me because as an athlete that had no talent at all, but loved the game, to see somebody that had the talent and not squandered it, but was turned off by it was really upsetting to me.
Yeah, that's you know, as I coach select ball now, Jeff, with 17-year-olds, you know, my prayer every day I go on that baseball field, my prayer is God, help me not to be that kind of coach that would yell and scream and you know, take away any type of passion that my players have. I want them to go through the game and enjoy it and learn and develop and take it as far as their talent and skill level will take it. And hopefully, prayerfully, there's not coaches and parents that steal that joy, that steal the environment for our kids to enjoy and participate in. Unfortunately for Joey, that's what he did. He rebelled against his dad, and he just finally got so tired of it. He said, that's it. I'm done. I'm done playing the game because I can't stand going to the ballpark and getting the negative feedback game after game after game. And he just finally quit the game. And so that you're right. That's it's a waste of talent. But I think about that kid's life forever changing when he had the talent to go play at a higher level and to be successful. And who knows, he may have made it to the big leagues. He may not have, but to allow a parent to steal that joy from him and the future success he could have had, that it was a painful story.
I agree. We're speaking with Mr. Pat Collins. Pat has written a book. He's a former major league pitcher with the Philadelphia Phillies, and we're going to talk a little about his career, but his new book is called More Than the Score. It's How Parents and Coaches Can Cultivate Virtual and Young Athletes. It's a really interesting book. Pat, I don't want to give away the whole book in this interview because I can certainly touch base on about 20 different stories that you mentioned in the book, and I want to leave something for the readers. They do pick up the book, but I really liked how it was all laid out. It was a very easy read. One of the things that we mentioned earlier was passion, and obviously you had a passion as a young man. And one of the stories that I really gravitated towards it and loved was that one of your uncles was a collector of baseball cards.
And that's right. Yep.
What was your goal when you saw that he was collecting baseball cards? That really was kind of neat.
Yeah, it's my Uncle Chet, and it's amazing. He still collects cards. He has his own website, Rockies Cards. He still deals with baseball cards and is actively involved. The really cool part of the story as well is that Chet's son, Jordan, my cousin, also pitched in the big leagues for the Detroit Tigers. And so he had, just his starting of the collecting of baseball cards years ago. Who could have foretold that he would have a nephew and a son both playing the big leagues? But, Chet really got me going in terms of when I was a kid, going to the 7-Eleven, and I would take my lawn mowing money that I would save up, and he would take me into the 7-Eleven. We would buy cards together and go home and rip the packs open, and of course that's the old Topps cards with the the hard gum. It take you hours to chew it, but we would go through our cards together, and I made that comment to him when I was probably about 8 years old, that one day I'm going to have my face on a baseball card. Kind of just a young kid's dream, but to see it come true, that was pretty cool to think back on.
Yeah, I mean, as a collector, I've been collecting since I was a little boy. My dad actually owned a pharmacy, and he used to bring home the cards to us, me and my brother and I. So I've been collecting since I was 4 or 5 years old, and that was always one of my dreams. But unfortunately, I just didn't have the chops like you had. So my kids actually gave me my own baseball card for my podcast for Christmas. So
you've got your face on a card. It doesn't matter how you get it. You got your face on a card. I love it.
That's right. Now, I'd like to talk a little about your career, if it's okay. I'm really interested in the time you spent, in Team USA and going around the world, basically playing against all these international players, and it must have been a really cool experience.
Jeff, I look back on that part of my career, and as much as I love playing in the big leagues and putting that Phillies uniform on, there was nothing like putting the red, white, and blue on across your chest that said USA. And I think back to those moments often because of the pride and the team that we had was phenomenal. But just the pride of getting to wear that uniform together and going out and representing our country on the international stage, it was unlike anything I've ever experienced or felt before.
That was a U.S. Team that won the gold medal in Seoul in 1988. Who were some of your teammates on that team?
Yeah, I know folks will remember, Jim Abbott was probably the easiest name to remember, but we had a phenomenal team. The pitching staff was made up of a number of first-round picks and made it to the big leagues. We had Andy Bennis, number one pick overall in 88. We had Ben McDonald, who was the overall number one pick in 89. And we had Charles Nagy, who was around forever as a closer with the Indians. And then we had, as far as position players, we had Tino Martinez at first base. Scott Service was our number one catcher. Ed Sprague at third base, played for many years with the Blue Jays. Tommy Goodwin in the outfield, played a number of years with the Dodgers. Ted Wood. I mean, Mickey Morandini at second base. I mean, it was a loaded team. And the difference was when you go to the international stage, I'll just remind some of the listeners that, back then in those days, we didn't use our professional athletes to play in international baseball. The USA was made up of amateur players. So we were 20, 21 years old, still in college, playing against the country's professional team. So Japan sent their professional all-star team to the Olympics. Cuba, that was their professional all-star team. So we were playing against some of these teams, Jeff, that were absolutely loaded with, you know, 28, 29, 30-year-old men who had been on the international stage and played in their professional leagues in their respective countries. And for us to win the gold, some of the sports writers at that time said, us winning the gold in 88 was equivalent to when the hockey team won the gold medal against the, you know, in what was it, the 80 Olympics?
Yeah, and against Russia, sure.
Yep, Lake Placid. Yeah, so it was really that much of a difference in terms of the teams that we saw in terms of USU's and amateur players versus playing the professional players.
So that's kind of really cool. And do you still have your gold medal today, I'm assuming?
Well, I didn't get a gold medal. So it was a demonstration sport in 84 and 88. And they had limited rosters that were active rosters during that time. So we only had 20 players that were on the active roster during the actual Olympics. Now, we had 23 players, so there were three of us that were alternates. And I was one of the alternates when we went into the Olympics to play in the actual Olympics. I played with the team the entire summer, but when we got there, they forced us to take the rosters down to 20.
Oh, well, that's not fair. They should have given you guys a medal.
I know. I look back at that and think how much that stunk. But we got back to the U.S. They had a big celebration for us in our training facility where we were. They gave us they had rings made. We got to celebrate with gold medal rings. So next best thing, I guess.
And you still have your uniform? Did you frame it and have it hanging up in your man cave or your office?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we've had plenty of offers to sell that. That's something we'll never sell. My sons each have an Olympic jersey that they'll get. But, those are one of those cherished things that'll never be let go.
That's fantastic. Now, you drafted in the first round by the Phillies, Philadelphia Phillies, 11th overall. Just a side note, you are actually the fourth Philly pitcher to be on my show. I've had Jim Cott, Jim Lomborg, Randy Lurch, and you are my fourth Philadelphia Philly pitcher, so you guys are well represented.
Hey, that is great company, Jeff. I'll be a part of that group anytime.
Yeah, they were all fantastic guys, and I appreciate them being on the show. And you rocketed right through the minor leagues. You were one of only four players to play in four different levels and reach the major leagues in the same season, right?
Yeah, I think that's the trivia question behind that, Jeff, is that I was the first player in Major League history to go in my drafted year to go A-ball, Double-A, Triple-A to the big leagues in my first professional year. And then, unbelievably, Andrew Jones did it like two seasons later, and I think we're still the only two guys to have taken that track.
That's something to be proud of. You had a great first six games. You were 4-0 with a great ERA, and you must have thought it was going to be clear sailing from there.
Yeah, the big league was really easy, man. I just I think a combination of things. You know, you get to that level. Of course, it's a dream come true, but you're almost. And I would say it this way, you're almost too dumb to recognize how difficult that is, you know, to win my first six starts in the big leagues. And it unbelievably difficult because of the talent. I mean, you play against those guys you grew up watching, and they're there for a reason. And when you get there, you know, I was so locked in to what I was doing at that moment. It was I had thrown in Triple-A. I'll take you one story backwards.
Sure.
When I got from Double-A Reading to Triple-A Scranton, George Culver, who was our roving pitching instructor in the minor leagues for the Phillies at that time, came to me and said I was pitching my final game at Double-A. He said, "Hey, we're going to move you to Triple-A, and just got to get a bearing on where we're going to start you for next year." And I remember sitting in the manager's office saying, "George, that's great. I want to go to Triple-A for sure, but what about the big leagues? I mean, the Phillies need pitching, and you know, the season's pretty much lost. Why wouldn't they just bring me up there and let me pitch in the big league?" He said, "Well, it's just not the plan. You know, we don't want to rush you. We want to make sure you're ready." And of course, my arrogant mindedness said, "Well, George, I am ready. Just take me, right? I'm ready to go." And he says, "No, you're not quite ready, but yeah, you're getting close. But we want to make sure, you know, we're going to start you for next year." I said, "Okay." So it kind of ticked me off that they wouldn't even consider moving me up that season, knowing one of my teammates from the USA team, Jim Abbott, started the season in the big leagues. You know, he never spent time in the minors. He went straight to the big leagues. And I thought I was at least on par with Jimmy. And so it kind of ticked me off the Phillies did that. So I proceeded to go out and throw a three-hitter, a shutout, one-hit shutout, and a four-hit shutout in AAA. And at that time, the GM of the Phillies, Lee Thomas, who had come over from the Cardinals, Lee saw my final shutout in Pawtucket. And if you know anything about Pawtucket, you know.
Yeah, I've been there many times.
But you know it, Jeff. It's very difficult to, you know, to throw a three or four hitter at that ballpark. I threw a one hitter shutout against the Red Sox, and Lee Thomas pulled me aside in the clubhouse. I didn't know he was there. Pulls me aside into an office. It was just me and him, and he says, "Well, I guess you're forcing my hand." And I said, "Forcing your hand in what way?" He says, "Well, the media in Philadelphia is telling me what an idiot I am if I don't bring you to the big leagues because of the way you're pitching." And I said, "Well, Lee, my desire was not to make you look bad. I just wanted to get to the big leagues." He said, "Well, you're coming. I'm taking you up next week." And so that's how it happened.
After your first big league win, the Philadelphia newspapers had an interesting headline, right?
Yeah, there was a number of them, but there was two or three of them I could mention.
Well, the one about the one that mentioned your mom.
Oh, yeah, yep. Yeah, that was the headline of the Philly Daily News. Combs and mom defeat the Pirates in his debut. Yeah, I had a very vocal mom. You talk about a baseball mom, that was my mom, Claudia Combs. Obviously my greatest fan, but she was the loud Italian lady in the stands that night for sure.
And you had to pay a little for moms.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I was never embarrassed by that at all. I got fined, you know, hundreds of dollars in kangaroo court because my mom was so loud, but I that did not matter to me. When I knew my mom was in the stands, I wanted to put on a good show for her.
Now, again, I don't want to give away all the stories, but I'm mentioning some of my favorite ones. And one of them, backing up a little, is your time in your first spring training when one of the Phillies legends walked through the clubhouse and made an announcement. You like to elaborate a little on that?
Yeah, you know, Mike Schmidt, obviously a Hall of Famer and, you know, just a tremendous guy to boot. I'll say this. I was raised in a very traditional home, and religion was important, but not that important to us. You know, baseball was my God for sure. There was no doubt. But when I got to the Phillies, and this is even after going to a Baptist school like Baylor, where you're required to go to chapel, although I skipped out every time I could. but Mike Schmidt shows up and announces that on the first Sunday of spring training that we've got baseball chapel in the media room next door. And I see some players getting up to go that way. And I figured, okay, well, I guess I better go to this chapel thing and thought it was a team event. So I'm following Schmidt and a few of the guys out. We get there. There's probably maybe 14 or 15 guys in the room. And I'm looking around. I said, Schmidt, where's the rest of the group? He says, well, hey, man, this is voluntary. I was like, okay, I'm out of here. So he grabs me by the back of his shirt and says, no, sit right down, rookie. You're already here. You're going to listen to this message. And that morning, a pastor from a local church at Clearwater Community Chapel came in and gave a message. And what was so shocking to me, Jeff, was, I was raised in Texas. So, you know, I've always thought, you know, Catholics were Catholics, Jews were Jews, and most Texans were Baptists. And this guy was a Jewish Christian, and I'd never heard that before. And Steve Kreloff was his name, and he gave a message that morning out of the Bible in the book of John, and it just kind of caught me that I had never trusted or had a relationship with God, and it just he just caught me at that right moment, thinking, man, I am in big league camp with the Phillies, and I've got this uniform on, and I've kind of fulfilled my dream, but still felt like there was something missing with that peace with God involved. And so that morning, trusted Jesus Christ to be my Savior, and that started just a whole radical redirection of my life. And so Mike Schmidt is responsible for that.
it's always strange to me and interesting how one innocuous event can turn somebody's life, and you just don't see it coming, and then something happens.
Yeah, no doubt, Jeff. And I'll say this in terms of you know, when people say, well, what was your life like before that? I mean, you seem to be a pretty decent guy. And I was a decent guy. I tried to treat people well. But, man, you know, you're coming up as a young athlete. I'll be the first to tell you, I'll raise my hand. I was arrogant. I was edgy, cocky. Man, I thought I was all that. And, you know, there's an element of that that you need to play at that level. I think you've got to be really confident about your abilities and your skills. There's no doubt about it, to get to the highest level of sport. But behind that is, you know, what is God doing in your life? What's really important? And you know, those are the things I needed to learn just as a human being, that God created me for this purpose to play baseball. But it was way beyond that. You know, what type of husband was I going to be to my future wife? What type of dad would I be to my future kids? And I knew there were some things missing in my life that I needed. And to start that journey of you know, reading the Bible and praying and really seeking God out in my life, and it was a radical redirection for me, for sure. And I'm thankful for guys like Mike Schmidt and other people that surrounded me in baseball. You know, baseball, it's a difficult sport, man. You're on the road a lot. There's a ton of temptations out there, and, you know, the money starts coming in. I mean, there's just a lot of things that can go wrong for a young person's life, and I'm so thankful for the way I was surrounded by really good people, good men, good women who helped me to you know, knock off some of those edges in my life and just become a better person.
Well, your competitiveness and your cockiness kind of reared its head in a game in 1990 against the New York Mets, and you had a little altercation on the mound.
Well, we just had a meeting in the middle of the field there at Shea Stadium between me and Doc Gooden and Darren Dalton. It was I thought it was going to be kind of a nice time to get together and chat, maybe, you know, talk about what we could eat after the game, but Doc wanted to throw punches, so we got into a little brawl.
That wasn't a very Christian thing to do.
I know. Well, here's the battle you have sometimes as a Christian ball player. You know, that was a game where we came out of the gate swinging the bat. You know, Doc had given up probably five or six hits. We hit a couple of home runs. You know, I know he didn't drill Dickie Thought on purpose, but two innings later, after another home run, he hits Tommy Herr. And I thought, okay, now wait a minute. Now it's two guys in the first four innings that get drilled after we've, you know, hit Doc around a little bit. And listen, Doc didn't control 100 miles an hour, but he also had pretty good control, too. So
it's like Roger.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, this guy, Doc was probably one of the better control pitchers, even as a power pitcher in the day. So you start to think, now wait a minute. If he's hitting our guys, what's my responsibility as a Christian, but as a ball player for my teammates? And that's the battle you have sometimes. Is, hey, I've got to do what's right here and take care of my teammates and make sure the Mets know they can't start throwing at our guys, you know. And so Doc came up and let off the fifth inning, and I hit him. Now, if you go back and look at the video, I think you'll see I hit him low. I wasn't going to ever hit anybody high. I wasn't out trying to hurt anybody's career. But there are times when you're called upon as a ball player to send that message to take care of your teammates. And I always felt that responsibility and loyalty to my guys, that I was not going to let the other team take advantage of them in that way. So that, again, you go through some of those times where, you know, when you look in the Bible, where does it say if you're playing baseball, you're never to throw at an opposing hitter? Well, it doesn't say that, but it does say, you know, we are to treat people with kindness and respect and respect authority. But there's plenty of instances in God's word where, you know, there were wars and battles and his people had to fight. And, you know, that's where you have to draw the line as a Christian is, what do I do here? You know, what am I supposed to, what's my responsibility and obligation to my team?
Did you ever discuss this with Doc after you guys have been retired, or have you met him?
No, I've never been able to discuss it with Doc. You know, we faced off one more time, and it nothing happened. He didn't throw at me. I, you know, didn't do anything else. But I did talk, unbelievably, with Daryl Strawberry, and about 5 years ago, got to talk with Daryl about the incident. And I don't know if you know anything about Straw's life, but Straw went through, you know, just a horrific you know, after baseball experience with drugs and just found himself at the bottom. And he also turned his life over to Jesus and has been, it's just totally, his life has been totally redirected as well. So Daryl Strawberry and I have had a chance to talk about that. He totally understands it. He said, look, even at the point it happened, we understood what was happening. But the fact that Dutch got on top of Doc in the pile and just, you know, had good, probably five or six good shots on his head. And when they pulled Doc out, you could see his face was blowing up pretty good. and that's why Daryl kept trying to start the fight. He was trying to get to Dalton to start things back up. And that fight went on for 25 minutes. But, you know, it's really crazy when you start to think, you know, 30 years later, Jeff, how lives get intertwined and some things come back in a way. You know, now we've lost Dutch, obviously, no longer with us. But,
yep.
You know, to come in, you know, 5 years ago to have this engagement with Daryl Strawberry and then to know more about his life and how God redirected him in such a way. It's just really, really interesting to see that.
We're speaking with Mr. Pat Combs from his home in Texas. Pat has written a new book. It's called More Than the Score. It's a great, I'm going to say it's certainly a Bible, and I don't use that in any disrespect, for parents and coaches on how to deal with young athletes and how to deal with themselves. There's a lot of common sense in the book, I think, Pat. And it was a real fun read for me as a parent, and I would highly recommend it for parents. What is there one thing you want people to take away from the book? I know there's a lot of information. We talked about a lot of stories. Is there one thing you would like somebody to take away from the book?
Yeah, Jeff. There's a lot of positive stories as well. We talked about some of the painful ones, and certainly I think the transparency of those stories I think will help parents relate. But you know, I had three sons, and really that. Right, you know, got to in writing this book was I wanted parents and coaches to see a process that if you put it to work, you've got a better chance at success with raising your kids through sport. And there's so many things they can learn from it. So, you know, when you think about just, you know, the laws of sowing and reaping come to mind. And with my kids, I saw that play out. You know, what kind of seed are you planting in their life? And what do you expect on the back end? And so there's the three stories of my sons, I think, is really when you get to chapters 7, 8, 9, 10, we tell the story about my oldest son who was a hockey player and played collegiately and then ended up having an opportunity to start a college hockey program at a D3 school. And, you know, not knowing when he was age 4 that was ever the plan that God had for his life, that someday he would use Carson to build a program and bring kids into a great school that they could have an opportunity to play hockey in college. And then my middle son, Connor, who now works with me in our wealth management company, Combs Capital Partners, and just to see Connor's, you know, going through youth baseball up into college baseball and becoming one of the first players to ever win Academic All-American of the Year for the NCAA 2 seasons in a row. And just to see what God did with his life. And now him on the other side of that, of sport, and all the things he learned from competitive sports to apply in his work life. And then finally, my youngest son, who now plays with the Miami Marlins, he's a catcher. But I'll tell you that the really cool part of that story, Jeff, which I still think is a miracle, is Casey had a really bad shoulder injury from football here in Texas in his junior year, and tore his labrum. You know, his shoulder was messed up. We had surgery. The Texas Rangers team doctor did the surgery, Dr. Meister, and it turned out well. But, you know, you have a labrum surgery as a catcher, it takes a full year to really get your arm back. And he just got to that point where he just got so tired of battling the injuries. He came to me after a senior year in baseball. He had multiple offers to play college, but he said, Dad, I'm just so tired of fighting the injuries. I think I'm done playing. And I remember that day, it was a heartbreaker for me because I could see the disappointment on his face of all the hours and years of work that went into honing his skills and then to lose it to an injury. And I went through that. And so I knew the pain there, Jeff. It was a tough day. And then 6 months later, his brother calling him and saying, Casey, our catcher went down at East Texas Baptist where he played. He said, we need a catcher. Like, do you have it in your heart to come back and play? And I'll never forget Casey running downstairs from our home and saying, Dad, Connor just called me and said they need a catcher, and I missed the game. I think I want to go back and play. So he walks on to a D3 school, and 4 years later gets drafted by the Marlins. Now he's a professional baseball player, and Jeff, there's stories like that. I mean, you just never know what God will do with your kids if we can plant the right seeds and nurture them along and do the right things with them to give them those opportunities down the road. So that's the thing I think I'm most proud of, and just the way my wife and I were able to work through a number of different issues with our kids and get to the other side and see what kind of character and virtue that these kids possess now. And I point back to their lives in sports. They've learned a ton on the ball fields, and I'm just so thankful they had great coaches, great mentors, and people who poured into them so they could become the young men that they are today.
Yeah, and I think you really outlined that in the book. It's called More Than the Score. It's available on Amazon. Is it in bookstores as well, Pat?
Not yet. We're hoping to get there, but I think, you know, for a first-time author and you get a book published, you hope to get at least enough attention on Amazon. You can put it in a bookstore.
True. Now, you know, we are an autograph and collecting show. We talk to former athletes about them, you know, dealing with collectors, and I'm sure you know different in terms of people asking for your autograph or sending requests through the mail. Do you still get a lot of requests through the mail?
Man, Jeff, it's amazing. I still get probably two or three letters a day. I think, as you would well know, if you've got former players who want to give back to the game, and I so respected the fans, the fans who came to the ballparks, the fans who watched this, you know, on TV, the fans who were involved in the game in so many different ways. You know, that's who we play for. And I just get such great respect for people who love the game and are collectors. And there was a time when I was raising my kids, I wasn't as good at getting the cards returned. And in fact, I'll tell you a brief story in just a moment. But today, I've got a little bit more time. So when those cards come in, I try to turn them around within a day or two. And I personalize the cards. I put a scripture on there that's important. I just want fans to know how much I appreciate them, and collectors especially, that are still involved in the game in that way.
Now, I'm sure if someone buys the book and sends it to you, you'll gladly sign it for them.
Oh, absolutely. You bet. And then the one story I'll tell you was in our move from Houston to the Dallas area, we live in a little town called Southlake. I had some cards that came in. I put them in a box. I think it was probably maybe 30 or 40 letters of cards. Put in a box that somehow got just lost in storage. Well, years later, I'm going through this box. It's probably 6 years later. I find this box, and it was these cards that were sent that wanted, you know, folks that wanted them signed. I was like, oh, no, I can't believe I just misplaced this box for so many years. And I took a chance thinking hopefully people still live in the same location or maybe the mail could get forwarded. But I sent every one of those letters back, Jeff, and none of them got sent back to me, so hopefully they reached the right destination.
You're a good man, Pat.
I know one did because a guy posted on a blog somewhere and said, hey, I've been collecting cards for 30 years and autographs, and I got this card back I sent 6 years ago to Pat Combs. And my son somehow saw that, and he said, Dad, do you realize you didn't sign a card for 6 years? I said, I know. I found this box. I just felt so horrible. And he said, no, the guy actually is praising you. He's like, I can't believe he would find this card 6 years later and send it back to me.
It happens. It does happen. I probably had a couple that have been 2 or 3 years because I've only been collecting for a couple years this way. But every once in a while, I had a collector on my show when I first started, and he had sent a card out to Glenn Hubbard, who played for the Braves second baseman.
Oh, yeah.
And I think it was 18 years.
Oh, no.
From the time he picked it up when he got it back, and it was probably the same thing. It probably fell behind a table and Glenn Hubbard signed it and sent it back, and he had moved. And what happened was that the postman knew his daughter. They went to high school together, and his daughter lived like three streets over. So when the guy saw the letter, he delivered it to his daughter, and then the daughter gave it to this gentleman, who ended up, he was a principal at a elementary school.
Oh, that's outstanding. Well, hey, Glenn Wynn, he beat me on that deal.
Yeah, he, you know, this guy kept meticulous records, so he had all his records. He hadn't been collecting for, you know, 15 years. Somehow he kept all his records, and he went back and said, yeah, I sent this out in like 1991 or whatever. This is crazy.
Oh, man. That is awesome. Well, Jeff, I still collect cards myself. I've been a collector since 1975 when I was a kid. I have not ever sold a card. I've kept every card I've ever collected. At one point, I thought, you know, my wife was like, why do we got to keep these hundreds of boxes of cards? I said, honey, this is going to pay for our kids' college one day, right? Of course, that never happened. But we still have all those cards in storage, and I just cherish them. I really do. I mean, at some point, it may make sense to sell them or give them to the grandkids. But, yeah, it really is. It's once you get those, and I think back to all the yards I mowed and all the money I saved up to get those cards, it means a lot to me. It's very sentimental.
Yeah, too bad you opened all the packs, because the unopened packs are worth a lot of money nowadays.
Oh, man. No kidding. Yeah, I did. I opened up every pack. I was so excited to get to those things.
Me too. Do you remember, seeing your first card, or did you go to the store and pick up a couple packs open to get yourself on a card?
Well, my first card was the Olympic team 1988. Topps did the extended set, you know, include the Olympics. Now, we had some cards made by the USA group, which I still have. In fact, those cards are very valuable. It was, I've got one on my desk here. That was my very first card, but my first, I think, official top card was the 88 extended set.
Okay. And now, did you, while you were playing or after your playing days, did you try to get collect autographs or get, you know, trade shirts with guys or, you know, bats or anything like that?
Man, I wish I had done more of that. I've got some a few select items. I've got a Dale Murphy bat that's signed. You know, I've got a couple of other bats like that in the collection and a few balls. But, man, Jeff, I didn't do enough of it, and I should have done more. My son even has said, Dad, why didn't you trade jerseys or something? I said, well, that just wasn't a thing back then. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, the clubhouse guys were not giving jerseys out like they do today.
So. Yep. Well, I know Pat Neshek is a big card collector and an autograph collector. Are you still playing? Do you have the ball from your first hit or the glove from your first win or anything like that?
I do. Yeah, I've kept all the equipment and the balls are stored away safely. But yeah, those are mementos we want to keep in the family for sure. But I've had plenty of requests of people who said, "Hey, can you send me game used stuff?" I've given away like a few items that were not as important, but yeah, for the most part, we've kept it all. And after I had, you know, you have sons, and you start to think at some point the boys will want these items.
Yeah. Do you remember your first hit?
I do remember my first hit. It was against Bob Walk in the Pittsburgh Pirates.
Yep. Single, double?
It was a single, and then later on I hit a double, but that the first hit was a single.
And I saw you had one stolen base in your career. Do you remember that one?
Yeah, I actually got caught in between, and I'll tell you the quick story on that. So that was that goes back to some poor coaching. So if you remember, John Vukovic was our first base coach, and Larry Bowe was a third base coach. So Larry gives the sign, and I turned to Vuk, and I said, "Vuk, did he just give me the steal?" And Vuk's kind of like shaking his head. Well, the count is on the hitter. It was our leadoff. I think it was Lenny Dykstra. So the count on Dykstra was 2-1. Boa thought the count was 1-2.
Oh.
So he's giving me a steal. And I'm thinking, why is he giving me a steal? And this is in Montreal. So I get off the base. I start to go, and then I realize after Lenny takes the pitch that it's a ball, and I'm just hung out to dry between first and second. So I start to head back to first. The catcher pops up and throws it to first base, and I turned around, went to second, and slid into second safely. And I'm standing at second base, and Bo is screaming at me. And I'm turning around to Vukovic. I'm looking at Vuk, and Vuk is just shaking his head, right? And so I walk off the field at the inning, and Bo is just in my ear. What are you doing trying to steal? I didn't even – I said, Bo, I promise you did. Ask Vuk, right? So, oh, man. I got rung out for that one. But, yeah, and then, of course, after the game, they're like, listen, pitchers, we're never going to give you a sign.
We're just amazed you got on first base.
That's exactly right. How did you get to first anyway? Well, I was a pretty good athlete. I could run a little bit, and thankfully I was safe because I can't imagine what kind of ringing I would have gotten if I was thrown out.
Did you ever get come close to a home run? I know I saw you didn't hit home runs. Did you ever come close?
Not in the big leagues. I hit one in AAA. Against Ottawa when we were up in their ballpark. But yeah, that was the only home run I had in the minors.
One more than I had in my whole career, so.
And I did have a triple one time too.
Little league backyard baseball, and anything else you can say.
Oh man. The triple was costly because I ended up pulling my groin. I was coming around second base, and I'm kind of looking back towards right field to see where the ball was, and I tweaked my groin, and so that wasn't really smart. But yeah, I could hit the ball, Jeff. I wasn't like a great hitter, but I think I had maybe a 180, 190 career average, so I could put the ball in play. But the thing I could do as a pitcher, and what you learn in the National League, you really got to get good at, is bunting. I could put down a good sack bunt.
Yep. We're speaking with Pat Combs. Pat is the author of More Than the Score. Pat, why don't you let people know where they can find your book if you if they want to reach out to you, if they have any questions, website, all that kind of stuff. That'd be great.
You bet, Jeff. Thank you again for having me on and for promoting the book like you have. More Than the Score, you can buy it on Amazon. You can also get it on christianbook.com, cb.com. You can also find it at manhoodjourney.com or .org, I'm sorry. Manhood Journey is the group that helped me to publish the book, a guy named Kent Evans, a dear friend who really helps dads and guys be better husbands and dads. So manhoodjourney.org.
Very good. Now, guys, I recommend this book as a parent and as if you ever coach or you've got young kids. It's a very good book. There is some religious overtones to it, but I'm not the biggest religious guy, but Pat works well, and there's all sorts of into the book, and there's some stories about baseball in there, and stories about Pat dealing with his kids in terms of how growing up and dealing with his wife. And the one thing that scared the heck out of me, Pat, was you were riding in the car, and he said, "Give me, rate your marriage," and then you gave him the phone.
Well, Jeff, I did not give him the phone. He took my mobile phone and started calling my wife. After he asked me how our marriage was going, and it's a mentor, a guy that I still work with, and he asked me to give my marriage a score. And I said, well, his name is Flip. I said, Flip, my marriage is great. It's a 9.5. And he's like, well, that's great, man. That's spectacular. It sounds like you and Christina are doing great. I said, yeah. So he lets it go for 15 minutes. He picks up my phone and puts it to his ear. And unbeknownst to me, had called Christina as we're still driving down the road. And he said, Christina, this is Flip. Hey, everything's fine. I've got Pat's phone, obviously. But I wanted to talk with you for a second. We were talking about marriage, and I just asked him how good your marriage is, and he gave it a score. And on a 1 to 10, he says it's a 9.5. And I just want to hear from you. Where do you think it is? Give me a score. And my face is about as cheery red as it can be. My head's about to pop. I had tried to grab the phone a couple of times, thinking, what is this guy doing? And then I can hear her in the background, talking. I can hear her say a 4. And now I'm really ticked off. I'm like thinking, does she have any idea? She's like just throwing me under the bus here with this guy. In fact, he was my boss at the time. I said, I've only been working with this guy for 3 months. Well, it's a leadership development company, Jeff, so you can imagine, after the phone call, I was so upset. And he said, now Pat, listen, we got some work to do. And I can't believe you did that. I can't believe you picked up my phone and called my wife without, my permission. He said, well, you're driving right here. You're sitting right next to me. I said, yeah, I tried to grab the phone twice. He said, listen, I don't care that it's a 4 today, but it's not going to be a 4 next week, and we're not going to ever let it get down to a 4 again, right? And I'm like, oh. and Jeff, I got to tell you, a lot of guys have been exposed in different ways, right? But that was painful for me. I'm like, I've never been a 4 in anything. I never considered myself a 4 in anything I've ever done. And then my wife is telling my boss that I'm a 4 in my marriage. And I got to tell you that the emotions I had driving home that night, thinking I'm going to air her out. I'm going to let her know how ticked off I am. And I got there, and it was just like, I grabbed her, hugged her, and this is the part that gets emotional for me, because Jeff, that day, as much exposure and pain that I went through thinking what she just did, that set me on a course to change my marriage and to treat her better. And that was, as painful as that was, I look back at that day and it was probably one of the best days of my life, because I made a commitment to my wife. I would not ever treat her like a four again. And look, we've had our struggles, and like all couples do, but man, she is just the most awesome wife, and she'll remind me, hey, you're getting close to a four again. That's all it takes, man.
Yeah, she sounds like a ball buster. I'm married to one.
Oh, yeah, she is. But you know what? You love those types of women who can hold you accountable, because you know what? At the end, she's trying to make me a better man, and I'm so thankful God put a woman like that in my life, because I there's no telling where I'd be, Jeff, if I didn't have a really strong wife like that, and I'm thankful. And it did, you know, when you think back the effects it has on your kids and what kind of kids they'll turn out to be, I'm just thankful. She's tough, but she's awesome.
Well, Pat, thank you again for sharing stories. I hope I didn't give away too many of the good stories from the book. Guys, there are many other stories, and there's a story about Nolan Ryan. There's all sorts of stories about Pat growing up. It's a really easy book to read. Don't know where life lessons are going to come, and I'm not preaching to anyone, but I think it's a nice book to read, especially if you're a parent or if you're a coach, or you're thinking about it to be a parent. Pick up a copy of More Than the Score. It's by Pat Combs. It is available on Amazon. Pat, once again, thank you very much for spending some time with me today.
Hey, Jeff, it was an honor and a pleasure, and thank you for reading the book and for promoting it. That means a lot to me, and my hope and prayer for the folks who picked up is that it transformed your life as well. So thank you, Jeff.
You're welcome. I wish you luck.
Appreciate it. Take care.
Thanks. Bye.
Well, that wraps up Season 2, Episode 38 of TTM Cast, the podcast for the TTM Autograph Collector. My name is Jeff Baker, and I have been your host for the program. I just want to remind you, if you have any TTM trick-or-treat stories or TTM horror stories that you'd like to feature on next week's show, please send me a quick email to ttmcast@yahoo.com. Once again, the email address is ttmcast@yahoo.com. Just put trick-or-treat story in the header, and anyone that submits a story that I use on next week's podcast will get a TTM Cast treat. Well, our next show again will be next Sunday, October 25th. That will be our Halloween show, and I think I've got another interview scheduled. I'm going to try to interview the gentleman this week to include that for next week's show. I want to thank Mr. Pat Combs for joining us today, former Major League pitcher with the Philadelphia Phillies, and of course, Pat wrote a new book. I recommend you go check it out at More Than the Score. If you buy it on Amazon or get a copy of it, send it to Pat. He will certainly autograph it and return it to you. Also, Pat is very good at signing TTM requests, so if you have a card of Pat's you want to sign, get signed, please just send it out to him. He's very good at returning TTM requests. I think that wraps it up. I want to thank everyone for listening. All you guys hanging in. I know we had a little longer show this week, but we had a nice long interview with Mr. Combs. And I just want to, again, as always, wish everyone many happy returns. See you next week.